Attorney General Loretta Lynch put it, state-sponsored discrimination and provides no benefit to society. On the same issue, the administration issued a sweeping directive to public schools. Transgender students must be allowed access to bathrooms that correspond with their gender identity, now under review by the U.S. Supreme Court. Also in the last year, transgender men and women can now serve openly in the military, and they are on a pathway to receive complete health care, inclusive of transition-related medical needs. I obviously welcome these steps. There must be many more. But I am not a one-issue voter confined solely to LGBTQ issues. I am a conservative, and always have been, particularly on fiscal issues, and I am not going to change to make myself more popular or more politically palatable. I did not transition to become a liberal Democrat. I believe that we desperately need conservatives like myself who have a platform and can use it to enlighten fellow conservatives, reminding them of the golden rule, that trans people should not be judged on moral or religious grounds, but rather treated as fellow human beings. Whatever advances we have made, our community is still in dire straits. The shockingly high rates of suicide that show no sign of abatement, the rates of violence and unemployment that are far higher than the general population, and the states making it extremely difficult to change gender markers on official documents such as driver's licenses and birth certificates. The conservative community must be reached to address these critical roadblocks to our equality. I can only reach them by getting them to the table, not by bashing them. Republicans are also in power, the House, the Senate, and the presidency. I will try as hard as I can to make the government see that lives are at stake. It will be an uphill struggle. I am not starry-eyed, but I do have experience in attaining goals that no one thought possible. I won the decathlon at the Olympics by going after the impossible. I became Caitlin after saying to myself for 65 years that it was impossible. Change comes in the unlikeliest of circumstances, unless you give up trying to effect change. I make a point to answer questions without regard to spin or personal reputation. I swear that my heart is always in the right place, which isn't to say that I am always right. Articulating what I believe is much more important to me than articulating what I want people to think I believe or what people think I should believe. I have been through that already in my life. During a commercial break after the first taped segment of my Ellen appearance in September 2015, Ellen DeGeneres leaned over and, to the best of my recollection, said in a friendly voice, "You know, I heard your views on the Marriage Equality Act and same-sex marriage have really progressed over the years." "Yes, they have." "I would love to talk about that." I believed, as anyone would, that that was exactly what she wanted to talk about, my progression in terms of changing attitude over the years. I said the following when we came back on the air. "Gay marriage. I have to admit that I remember 15 years ago, 20 years ago, whenever it was, the whole gay marriage issue came up at first. I was not for it. I mean, I thought I am a traditionalist. I'm older than most people in the audience. I mean, I kind of like tradition, and it's always been between a man and a woman, and I'm thinking I don't quite get it. But as time has gone on, like a lot of people on this issue, I've really changed my thinking here to, I don't ever want to stand in front of anybody's happiness. That's not my job." Okay, if that word marriage is really, really that important to you, I can go with it. Ellen responded, "It's funny. You're still kind of a little not on board with it." I was surprised when she said that. I am for it. I did not initially understand why marriage was so important, influenced no doubt by my own personal experience. Now I do, and it is a wonderful thing to see. After I appeared on the show, I was publicly accused of being a hypocrite. How can someone in the trans community not be open-minded enough to support the Marriage Equality Act? This discussion only further alienated me from members of the LGBTQ community. Ellen's appearance on the Howard Stern show, where in my mind she even more emphatically took what I said out of context, made it go viral. Several months later, in a lengthy interview in Time magazine in December 2015, after being on the shortlist for Person of the Year, I was asked a question about image. I gave the following reply. "One thing that has always been important to me, and it may seem very self-absorbed or whatever, is first of all your presentation of who you are. I think it's much easier for a trans woman or a trans man who authentically kind of looks and plays the role. So what I call my presentation, I try to take that seriously. I think it puts people at ease. If you're out there and, to be honest with you, if you look like a man in a dress, it makes people uncomfortable." Not a great career move. I have examined what I said in Time. I have thought about it, but I won't disavow it. A trans woman who looks like a man in a dress makes people uncomfortable. Just watch the look on their faces when they see one, or how they instantly look away. Any man wearing a dress for whatever reason makes them uncomfortable. Any man who wears nail polish makes them uncomfortable. Anyone who is gender fluid makes them uncomfortable. The majority of the public is made uncomfortable by anything that isn't mainstream. It is a commentary on them and not the other way around. But we cannot ignore it. What I am trying to do, what I am doing, is to ultimately make the mainstream public comfortable with us, or at least semi-comfortable, since changing attitudes may be the hardest societal task of all. The best way for me to do that right now is to meet people and show them I am friendly and normal, because I am friendly and normal to the degree that anyone is normal. Like every other trans person I have met, I want to be accessible. Am I engaging in some superficial notion of womanhood because I want to look as good as I can? Actually, the reason is simpler than that. I like to look good. It is important to me. I am not trying to make any judgment on womanhood as it applies to physical characteristics. I have absolutely no right to do that. I also know that I have the money for surgeries, a luxury that most trans women do not have. For me, it boils down to the fact that some women and some men are consumed with the way they look, and some just care the usual amount, and some don't care at all. It is a trait of personality, and everyone is different. All the criticisms sting, but I brush them away. I will continue to push issues facing the transgender community in the best way I see fit, disregarding those who attack me for the advancement of their own agenda or to be inflammatory in the inflammatory age in which we live. But I have learned some lessons. The next time Eddie Redmayne plays a trans woman, count me out. Chapter 9. Here's Brucey. The first time I hear the name Kris Kardashian is in Ketchikan, where all I just want to do is catch a fish. I am in Alaska in 1990 with former Los Angeles Dodgers and San Diego Padres first baseman Steve Garvey and his wife Candace, shooting a television show in which we are salmon fishing. I have known Garvey for a long time. The fraternity of sports celebrities is smaller and tighter than Yale's Skull and Bones, and the arc of his public life has been eerily similar to mine. When he was with the Dodgers and Padres, he was known as Mr. Clean. He played through whatever it took for 1,207 straight games, still the National League record. His sturdy, solid jaw looks were referred to over and over again. He inherited the crown of the All-American sports hero after I lost it because of my messy personal life and controversial divorces. The press went over the top in depicting him just like they did me. Sports Illustrated wrote, "For most of his 41 years, Garvey lived at the corner of straight and narrow. He played football at Michigan State, graduated with a B average, signed with his boyhood idols, the Dodgers, married the prettiest girl in school, and had two daughters Norman Rockwell might have painted. Sound familiar? It sure did to me. From my own experience, I knew there was only one way for Garvey to go, and that was down into the pits. Garvey's messy personal life, culminating in a horrible divorce from his first wife, Cindy, in 1983 that went public, and a child born out of wedlock after an affair, turned Mr. Clean filthy. He had done what he had done, but it was the glee and venom and mockery with which he was dismantled that I so identified with, built up by the media, out of all proportion, and then crucified for it exactly as it was for me. The only thing worse than being called Mr. Clean is the Golden Boy, or Prince Valiant, or Adonis. It's probably why we are fishing together in Alaska, the ultimate hideout where not even the bears read the tabloids. I am wearing sweatpants, attire I think appropriate for fishing. Maybe I look a little slovenly for television, but I have never been a clothes horse. As far back as I can remember, it was the women in my life, starting with my mother, who bought all my clothing, with the exception of that pair of tight bell-bottoms in college. My lack of style is such that GQ, a magazine dedicated to style, has gone out of its way to point out that I have none. Candace shows up in her customary outfit of head-to-toe Ralph Lauren. She looks like she is just off the runway, not the kind of person interested in bait on the hook. She takes one look at me and decides this will not do at all, probably because she is right. I look even more of a wreck than usual because I am a wreck, trying to put together the pieces of my life and not really knowing if I will be able to. Candace thinks I need a woman. I have a friend who would be perfect for you. Who is it? Her name is Kris Kardashian. She is in the process of a divorce and lives in Beverly Hills. Beverly Hills? Way out of my league. I'm not interested. Steve, what do you think about Bruce and Kris going out together?
It'll never work.
Now I am interested. As much as I love Garvey, I generally try to do the opposite of anything he says. There is a reserve that just makes you want to go up to him and muss up his hair and watch as he uses a slide rule to put it back in place. But there is still hesitation on my part. Christy and Linda were both down to earth, a quality that attracted me to them and was similar to myself. A woman from Beverly Hills strikes me as the very opposite, most days spent shopping in the fashionable boutiques and brand-name stores that rim Rodeo Drive. Kris is also in the process of a divorce, and the last thing I need is somebody coming out of a divorce, given my own track record. Candace now tends to agree. She has four children. It would never work. The wheels click in my mind. She has four children. I have four children. That's eight kids. Kris has the same amount of baggage that I do. Now I really am interested. Candace quickly set something up for the following week. Garvey and I are playing in Magic Johnson's golf tournament at the Riviera Country Club, the historic course in Pacific Palisades. She invites Kris to join us at a party afterward and then dinner. Kris brings along her nanny, which is open to many interpretations, none of them good. The first time I see her, she is in a white pantsuit. She looks great. I go up to her at the party and put my arms around her. At last, in the arms of a real woman with four children. I am hoping she will laugh. She doesn't. But neither does she look at me like I am crazy. I actually think she is flattered by it, or at least thinks it is a step up from, "Hey, baby, want to touch my gold medal?" We mix into the crowd. I know a lot of people there in the way that men know a lot of people, which is to say we don't know anyone at all and float off once the sports talk is exhausted. Kris knows everybody and everybody knows her. They are much more happy to see her than me. I have never met anyone this effortlessly social. Who is this person?
I still don't know a single thing about her other than the little Candace has told me. We go out to dinner afterward at Ivy at the Shore in Santa Monica. It is one of those places to be seen, although I prefer to be in places not to be seen and think McDonald's approaches haute cuisine, depending on how crispy the fries are. I have the meatloaf and mashed potatoes because I always have the meatloaf and mashed potatoes when I go out if it's available. Chris knows a lot of people there as well, but once again, she doesn't work the room. She really knows these people. It reminds me there is an entire world out there that I knew existed but never felt comfortable with. But I am still not entirely hooked. Right before we leave, Chris applies pencil outliner on her lips. She doesn't even use a mirror. She just goes zip, zip, zip. It's perfect. Now, I actually know something about using pencil outliner, and it's very hard to do without a mirror, although I am proud to say I have mastered it. Now I'm hooked. A year ago, even 6 months ago, that simple act would have heightened my gender issues. I would have felt the familiar pang of envy that she can simply do this whenever she wants, wherever she wants. She doesn't carry a pack of makeup remover wipes in case the police stop her. She doesn't carry around a note from the therapist. She hasn't thought about gender a single minute in her life. Why would she? Why would anyone I know? It's not an issue. But now that I have decided not to transition, I'm trying not to make it an issue as well. Suppress my urges to the greatest extent possible. I cannot afford them in my life anymore. I don't want them. Chris and I start going out. I have a dinner scheduled one night with a producer acquaintance I know and bring Chris along. Since he is in the business, it is one of his job requirements to act as if he knows everyone in the business. He is showing off a little bit, another job requirement, self-importance as a work of art. But every time he mentions someone, Chris says she not only knows her or him, but also the entire family, without trying to show off in the least. Finally flummoxed, the producer turns to her in the middle of dinner and says, "Who are you?" To which Chris says something so uncharacteristic of her today that it seems hard to believe she said it. But she did, because I was there. "I'm just a mom in Beverly Hills." Right at that moment, I see qualities in Chris that will serve her extraordinarily well and make her somebody one day. The way she deals with people and takes charge without them even knowing it. The habit of sending flowers or some other gift after a meeting. A combination of charm and professional intelligence, knowing that remembering a birthday goes a long way because of the attentiveness and thoughtfulness it implies. She is everything I am not. I am not confident. I am not comfortable in my own skin. I am not social. I am lousy at giving gifts. She is natural and disarming about it all. It doesn't feel remotely like name-dropping when she says she knows this person and that person. It is quiet, sweet, really. I have been in a rat hole the last 6 years, but I can feel Chris bringing me out of that even after our first few dates. It feels good to go out again after all those years in the Malibu shack. Whatever the differences that developed between Chris and me later on, and there were big ones at the end, she saved me at this point in my life, just like sports had saved me as a young child. I fall in love with Chris quickly. She falls in love with me quickly. We were married after a courtship of 7 months. Love is at the crux of us, but I believe, and this is my opinion and my opinion only, we both want something from each other. I know I do. Chris restores my credibility. She helps to restore the image of Bruce. I also believe, and once again, this is my opinion only, that Chris gets something from me. Her divorce from Robert Kardashian, a successful lawyer and entrepreneur later made famous for his ceaseless loyalty to his longtime friend O.J. Simpson when he was tried for murder, had been ugly. Chris had married when she was 22. She told me there was just much more life she wanted to live. She had been involved in an affair with a man in his 20s, which could not have been a boon to the marriage. But close friends of the couple were still shocked when she left. They could not understand why she was willing to give up the Beverly Hills lifestyle. They could not understand how she could cause such tumult to her children. They all loved Robert because there was a great deal to love about Robert. An incredible father, a man of decency who encouraged my role as a stepfather, as long as I always remembered that he was the father. Robert was angry as well. He could not believe that Chris was leaving. There was a great deal of acrimony. As in many difficult divorces, I believe that Robert wanted Chris to realize she had made a terrible mistake and end up in some crappy apartment in the valley. It didn't happen that way. We made a glamorous couple, clearly in love. We began to have success in business as a team. I was well known. So sometimes I wondered if Chris was making a statement to her former husband. A big fuck you. Since, let's not kid ourselves, everyone wants to know, Chris and I had good and frequent sex at the beginning. It is imbued with affection and love, but my attitude is no different than it was in high school. I'm just not entirely comfortable with it. Sex, to be sustained in a relationship, requires emotional tools that I simply do not possess because of fear of expressing emotion, to the point where it ultimately became easier to have it only sporadically and then not to have it. It means giving, and while I believe I am better now, I have never been good at it. I tell Chris about my gender issues before I make love to her. I don't want to repeat the unfairness of what I did to Linda, literally springing it on her one day after we had been married for several years. I don't tell her the full extent that Trudy Hill had said unequivocally that my condition would never change, and the only thing I could do was somehow try to live with it on my own terms. But I tell her a great deal. This will always be a subject of dispute between Chris and me as to how much she could intuit about my gender issues. She insists that she was taken by surprise by my ultimate transition to Caitlin, which obviously means, in her mind, that she did not know enough. On Keeping Up with the Kardashians, she shed copious tears in coming to grips with it. Given what she saw, the whole reaction seemed a little puzzling then, and seems puzzling now. All I know is what I know. I told her there had been a woman inside me all my life. I told her I dressed as a woman, and she knew I did, because I did it several times in front of her after we were married. I don't know how much I elaborated on the electrolysis to remove the hair from my face and chest, but I would say it was pretty self-evident. I also told her I had been in hormone therapy for roughly the past 4.5 years before stopping 6 months earlier. It was obvious that the effect of the hormones had caused something, two somethings to be exact. To me, they were the development of breasts, size 36B. To Chris, they were man boobs caused by my being out of shape. I was out of shape, but not out of shape enough in my mind to cause size 36B man boobs. In my mind, she must have known what they were, which would indicate someone very confused about gender. So the idea that she was later shocked by my transition is equally shocking to me. It implies that I left her in the dark about the severity of my struggles. At least to me it does. Let's leave it at that. Maybe the fact that we had healthy sex at the beginning, as well as my love of such macho activities as skiing and car racing, did indicate to her that my so-called maleness was intact. Maybe she thought that whatever gender issues I had, she could change me. I did tell Chris I was gender dysphoric, but given my decision roughly a year earlier not to transition, I was determined to never pursue such a path again, applying instead the same willpower and discipline of mind as I had when training for the decathlon. I did not want to ever live my life in seclusion again. I wanted the marriage to work and would do everything to make it work. We did have something going for us. We loved each other, and several years into the marriage had two wonderful children together in Kendall and Kylie. I also love and adore my stepchildren, and I felt the love was mutual as I played a pivotal role in raising them without ever thinking I was supplanting their father, because I was not. I wanted this marriage to work. Both of us did until the last 5 years, when it became acrimonious misery for both of us, a toxic combination of her withering anger with me and my defensiveness and generally being at each other's throats and the kids asking their mother why she yelled at me all the time. We had many great years together beforehand. It only began to implode when Keeping Up with the Kardashians became a runaway success and Kris was at the helm of a multi-million-dollar family franchise in which she controlled all the purse strings, including mine. As we are courting and I see more and more of Kris's personality, it is also clear she can also help me fix my relationship with my kids before it is too late. My connection to Bert and Casey and Brandon and Brody, who are now between 8 and 13, had never felt right. How could it when I lived with the three boys for, at best, a little more than a year each and never lived with Casey? I like imbuing them with the same sense of adventure that I have. Car racing, flying, motocross, activities on the edge. The boys love those activities and will become gifted at them, so something of me rubbed off. I know they were proud of the Jenner name, but my connection to them has never been stable. I know they felt close to me in the late 1980s, but given how much time I had on my hands because I basically wasn't working, I should have seen much more of them. Linda at one point said to Brandon and Brody that the only thing they need to know about their father is that he lives in an emotional wheelchair. That hurts terribly. But maybe it's true, turning on the switch of disconnect because of my own disconnect. I do know I love my kids. I do know I want to become a better and more present father. With four kids of her own, Kris knows what it means to be a parent, and she seems to relish juggling eight young lives into the mix. They all get together for the first time at Kim's 10th birthday party. There is no friction or jealousy, just the common bond of happiness. I sit back and watch and am incredibly moved by what I see. Maybe this can work. Maybe there is a way of making amends. Not long after that, Kris decides we are going on a ski trip to Deer Valley in Utah. She divides the living room of her Beverly Hills home into eight different piles to make sure each child has the necessary equipment, boots, poles, outfits, no designer required at that point, gloves, hats, and runs out and buys anything that is missing. There are two SUVs just for the luggage to the airport. It is only a family ski trip, albeit a complicated one with a lot of moving parts. But even then, you can see Kris take complete charge in the way that will one day make her so successful, figuring out every detail no matter how small, refusing to relax until everything is right in the exact way she wants it right. Once again, I sit back and marvel. Actually, it is much more than that. It is magical that I am here with this woman of vibrancy and style, going skiing with my kids and her kids and everybody having a ball, our true life version of Eight is Enough. All the children are there when we get married. Of the thousands of pictures that have been taken of me in my life, one in particular on my wedding day is my favorite. We are on a lawn outside a private home in Beverly Hills. I am sitting in the middle in a black tuxedo and white tie. Brandon is to one side of me, and Bert is standing behind him with one hand on Brandon's shoulder and the other holding his hand. Brody is on the other side leaning into me so much that our heads are touching. Casey is sitting in front of me in a white dress with a garland of flowers wrapping around her forehead, blonde and lithe and stunningly beautiful. My hand is resting on her forearm. Rob is next to her, looking a little shell-shocked, maybe because he knew something the rest of us did not. Behind Rob is Kim, who even then had the exotic features that will ultimately make her a worldwide sensation. On the other side, in a kneeling position, is Courtney, who looks like her sister Kim, but with longer hair and lighter features. She is happy and smiling, although I know she is struggling with the idea of a stepfather coming into her life. Behind Courtney is Chloe, standing and impish with a twinkle in her eye and also a touch of the devilish. Chris is in back in a strapless white gown with one arm around Bert and the other around Brandon. Sometimes pictures lie, particularly wedding pictures, but this one does not. It was magical. It was a miracle. It was truly perfect, or as perfect as anything can be in life. There was no family fame then, and no fortune. There was just us. Chris and I have to figure out how to generate income. I know I need to get back in the game. I am optimistic because I am always optimistic. As much as I struggle with my own issues, I still believe that things will work themselves out. But I have let my career go, and I am not sure at this point to what degree it can be rebuilt. The culture of celebrity does not look kindly upon those who disappear. Becoming relevant again once you have largely made yourself irrelevant is often impossible. The rumors of my private life don't help either. Like an infestation of termites, they have made their way into the palm tree corridors of Beverly Hills. Even some of Chris's closest friends, at least those who are still talking to her since the divorce from Robert, have heard about them. But Chris vigorously defends me, and after we get married, the rumors fade away. Her women friends now love me, and her men friends are probably jealous that I never have to shave. I am not quite sure where to start in resurrecting my career, but Chris knows exactly. She views it as still one of untapped potential that has been allowed to wilt. All it needs is someone to take charge, and Chris will be that someone. She looks at the team that has been managing me, Wallach, Rogers and Cowan, and my lawyer, Alan Rothenberg. I am still paying them in one fashion or another, either on retainer or by giving them a percentage of the business I generate. And Chris concludes that they have to go and go quickly because nothing has happened for quite some time. I come to the same conclusion, but the bonds of loyalty and the hatred of confrontation makes it impossible for me to sever the relationships. Chris has no such qualms. She doesn't know any of these people. This is business, purely business. Why are you paying this guy? Good question. How much are you paying this guy? Better question. How much has he done for you the last couple of years? Best question. We go to George's office. George is on one side of the table, and Chris and I are on the other. Chris does most of the talking. We're doing this on our own. George looks at me. I feel compelled to say something. You did a good job, but we're moving on. We're doing something different. I feel terrible. I shouldn't, because other than Grambling's White Tiger, the television project he brought to me, there has been little in the last 8 years, as far as I recall. Part of it, admittedly, is that I didn't want to do anything for some of those years. Chris and I both feel that I need a fresh start, but I feel like I have let him down because of our history. He was my first and best champion. He came to me before the 1976 Olympics when he saw a preview issue of the games in People with my picture in it. He called directory assistance for San Jose and asked for my number. Those were the days your number was listed. He dialed it. I'm a manager. I would love to talk to you. He flew to San Jose just to meet with me. Under amateur rules, I was not allowed to have a manager before the games. I told him that. It's not going to work out, but you never know what the future holds. I had a good instinct about George. I knew right then and there I would use him if there was any opportunity. He had shown faith in me, unlike all the other managers and agencies who only called me after I was a champion. He helped sort things out for me the final night of the games after the closing ceremony when I was naive about who was who. Like Irwin Weiner, the vice president of financial and talent affairs of ABC and the network's ultimate dealmaker. Everybody knew Irwin, except for me until 10 minutes before he approached, saying that ABC wanted to hire me. When I excitedly told George, he said it would be best not to commit to anything too quickly, since NBC and CBS were keenly interested as well. It was the beginning of a fun and beautiful relationship, particularly for the first 5 or 6 years when the offers were rolling in and George screened what made sense and what did not. But now the phone isn't ringing off the hook, and it hasn't been ringing off the hook for some time. He is getting 15% of my business, which he has certainly been entitled to in the past, but I need to market myself and reinvent myself. George is shocked. He is looking at Chris, trying to figure out exactly who this woman is and why she has such a hold on me. I know why she has a hold on me. I like strong women, and Chris is the strongest of the strongest. So poof, that's it for George. Chris streamlines the business. Ties to Rogers and Cowan are severed. The same with my lawyer. Chris starts making hundreds of calls to corporations extolling my speaking skills because she believes the Finding the Champion Within speech is still effective and powerful. She still thinks there are legs in those 2 days of my life in Montreal. She also sees potential in the licensing of my name on reputable exercise equipment, using as promotion the then ridiculously cheap infomercial at $500 for a half hour. Ultimately, we market such products as the Super Step, the Power Trainer, and the Stair Climber Plus. At the peak, 2,000 infomercials appear a month in 17 different countries. On a personal level, Chris gets me back in the gym after a long absence. I go to Gold's in Venice Beach, and with the exception of those breasts/man boobs, they remain even after stopping hormones. My body begins to build muscle and firm up again. I look good. I feel good. Sorry to the woman inside me. Brucey's back in business. March 30, 2016. I remember sitting in my room, afraid to go out. I am at the Mission Hills Country Club in Rancho Mirage in California. It is the first major championship of the Ladies Professional Golf Association, and I have been invited to play in the pro-amateur the day before the ANA Inspiration Tournament begins. Danielle Kang, a good friend over the years, is the pro. Abby Wambach is one of the amateurs. She helped keep me from tripping at the ESPY Awards 9 months earlier in my first public appearance. I will always be indebted to her for that. The sad sack snoops make note of what I am wearing, a purple skirt that is described as a micro-mini, when the fact is that all professional golfers wear a skirt above the knee to effectively hit the ball, a white quarter-zip sweatshirt, in other words, a standard golf jacket, and a white visor. They call me sexy, as if I dressed up for the occasion, when all I am doing is trying to play golf in an outfit that was given to me by Kang. I didn't even pick it out. Plus, what really pisses me off is that most of them don't mention my name, because I am on fire, folks. I love golf. For many years, it was my therapy, playing on the Sherwood Country Club course in Thousand Oaks, California, to have some peace and get away from the endless chaos of the Kardashian household filled with camera crews and fashion fitters and repairmen and everything else morning, noon, and night. I still love golf, more than ever since my transition. I always used to play alone, too awkward and uncomfortable to play with others. But now I join other golfers. Plus Sherwood, as high-end as it is conservative, changed its locker room policy without a bit of fuss or drama. I wondered how Caitlin would hit a golf ball as compared to Bruce, since Bruce hit it pretty darn good, 280 yards off the tee when the groove was right. The pro-am answers the question. Not only can Caitlin still hit the crap out of the ball, but her short game has improved. I score an eagle on the very first hole of the Dynashore tournament course, nailing it from 122 yards out. This time, at least one media outlet is where it needs to be. The Golf Channel is covering the event, and for the next 2 days, it shows the shot over and over. I'm spending the night at the Westin Hotel in Rancho Mirage, where there will be a party for the tournament later that night. It brings me back 4 or 5 years earlier, when I had stayed at the same Westin. It was the familiar routine back then of having to give a speech and finding a little window for the woman inside me to surface. So I got there the night before. After the now familiar rite of surveying the hotel like a cat burglar, I made the delightful discovery that this was a great place in which I could dress as I desired and walk around as long as I made sure to get a room on the ground floor, which of course I did. The rooms had sliding glass doors, which meant you could just go out the back and walk around at night outside with minimal lighting. I brought several outfits because I wasn't sure of what I was going to wear. I felt the pulse of fun and anticipation of getting dressed as usual. I heard a party going on. I went to the sliding glass door to look. It was a lesbian-only affair, and there were several hundred. I heard them talk, and I saw them laugh, and I saw the ease with which they interacted. I saw them dress the way they wanted to dress, and wear their hair the way they wanted. They had freedom, such beautiful freedom. I could not take my eyes off them. If there was ever a group that was understanding toward me, this would be it. I wondered if there were some trans women among them. I desperately wanted to slide those glass doors open and walk out into the mix of them. I just wanted to say hi in one of my outfits, have a glass of wine, and take in the new world like a revolving carousel. The hell with that. I would have led the party because I had been voted best dancer at Newtown High. Instead, I snuck out in my outfit in the opposite direction. I did my brief lobby walkthrough, and then I went back to the room. The party still beckoned with its peals of laughter. God, they were having a good time. I should have been there. Just do it. Just walk into the room and let them figure out who I am. But I was afraid. Afraid of what I was always afraid of. Getting caught. Being discovered. Subjecting my family to shame. Destroying what reputation I had left. I could not do it. Between keeping up with the Kardashians and some cosmetic surgery and growing my hair long, the sad sack snoops were already all over me at this point in the early 2010s. I could envision the immediate assumption they would make about the party because it was all female. Bruce Jenner cross-dresses at a lesbian event. The headline would have gone around the world. Twice. So I just sat in my room and continued to listen. The party, like the sun on the horizon, eventually shutting down. Sitting on the bed with my hands clasped, trapped behind the sliding glass door, still closed because I was too terrified to open it, I couldn't help but feel that I would do the same, carve out a life and somehow try to live with myself until I just shut down. Now I am back at the Westin after transition with nothing to hide. No more sneaking around whenever I could, looking forward and backward over both shoulders. No more walking the fairway in loneliness and isolation. A great layup to the green with no one else around to admire it. A golf cart always for one. I will go to the party tonight. Many of the top players in the LPGA are going to be there. I will have that glass of wine I was too afraid to have and be the self I was too afraid to be. My life is so much simpler now. I do what I want to do when I want to do it. Just for the record, Danielle Kang and I won the pro-am portion of the tournament. A month and a half later, in the middle of May 2016, I go to Las Vegas for the SkyBridge Alternatives Conference, known as SALT, a remarkable conclave of political leaders and hedge fund titans and top policymakers. As Bruce, I always liked going to Vegas, not for the gambling or the garishness, but because it was the best place of all to dress up, the only locale where you could do whatever you wanted and no one would notice. So I became almost giddy when there was a speech scheduled in Vegas. As I told Chris back in those days, "I'm off to Vegas. Have fun." Oh, I will. As always, I had my routine down to perfection. I left the house in Hidden Hills. Almost immediately, I drove to the back of a nearby parking lot. I applied makeup in the car, then tried on several wigs I kept hidden underneath the back seat and picked out the one that not only suited my mood, but best concealed my identity. Next came putting on a favorite outfit while still inside the car. Then 5 hours of blissful driving through hot and lonely desert until I got to a Holiday Inn parking lot on the Vegas outskirts and wiped all the makeup off and removed the wig and wiggled out of the clothes. I checked into my hotel room and did everything all over again. There can't possibly be a place in the world that has more mirrors per hotel room than Vegas, which is why I brought more than one outfit since it was so much fun to try them on. Then, right before the speech, I once again took everything off. The next day for the ride home, I put on minimal makeup and very dark sunglasses. I got back into the car, scanned for bystanders, and applied the rest of my makeup and put on another wig to disguise my identity and dressed in another outfit. Then I drove back across the desert to the same parking lot 5 minutes from the house where I took everything off and once again hid it. Then I went home like nothing happened.
How'd it go?
Fine.
Anything new?
Same old, same old.
It must get boring.
Never. The only problem with the Vegas routine was the Starbucks issue. I needed my grande vanilla latte, and there was one on the way back near Barstow. It meant going in dressed up or taking everything off again. So I drove on by, but I still missed the fix. I thought about it a lot, how I couldn't even get a cup of coffee the way I wanted. Finally, during an appearance in Lake Las Vegas, I had enough. I got dressed up early in the morning and walked to the nearest Starbucks. I ordered, the first time I can ever recall having an actual encounter with someone while in women's clothing. I disguised my voice as best I could.
"I'll have a grande vanilla latte."
"Anything else?"
"No, that's it."
For the first time in my life, I hoped there would be no more conversation. She told me the amount. I paid her and she gave me my change with the same cheerful expression she gave to everyone else. A few minutes later, the barista handed me my grande vanilla latte. God, that felt good. Even if it happened only once before I became Caitlin. Now, several years later, I am at the SALT conference. I am staying at the Bellagio and walking through the casino with a great outfit on. The atmosphere is the same as it was a few months earlier at the Westin. People stop me and talk to me and want to take selfies. They are genuinely excited to see me, and that gives me great gratification and strength. I can make a difference. I have made a difference. I love how they come up to me, their voices alive in excitement. "Caitlin! Caitlin!" God, that feels good. All the time. Chapter 10. Bye Bye Breasts. I will never get out of my mind Linda's reaction when she saw me dressed up in women's clothing in the New York hotel room for the first and only time. She was shocked, and shocked would have been okay. Sometimes you adjust to shock. It was much more how uncomfortable she was, how she could barely look at me, and when she did, her eyes were somewhere else, desperate to avoid any direct contact. Linda wanted to be supportive. Linda wanted to understand. But it was all too much, and I, in turn, felt not simply freakish, but dirty and indecent. A screwed-up weirdo unable to control his impulses, inflicting himself on others who wanted no part. We had had our differences. The marriage could not be saved, but in that room I felt she was revolted by me. I know she did not mean to, but her reaction was my greatest fear realized. With Chris, it is different. It is different because, unlike with Linda, who I never told a single thing until we had been married for several years, I talked to Chris about my issues very early in our relationship. She knows there is something inside me that must have a place to go. I blindsided Linda when I dressed up. She had no time to prepare and get emotionally ready, and neither did I, for that matter. Chris and I talk. She is willing to see what it feels like. So the first time I dress up in front of her, she seems comfortable. But I am the one who is uncomfortable. The memory of Linda's reaction still fresh, even though it was roughly 6 years ago. I get the feeling that Chris is willing to let me cross-dress on certain occasions only because this is what I want. She has no real interest, and it's kind of ridiculous of me to think that she would. So I stop after a few times. It is easier and causes fewer problems. She married Bruce. It is Bruce whose career she is trying to resuscitate. She has defended Bruce to her friends who have heard the rumors. Eventually, Chris and I do reach an understanding. Take Caitlin on the road, but she is not to play in our home or hometown. End of discussion. I am okay with that. I can handle it. The excitement of a new marriage and the resurgence of family and career are energizing. It really is a partnership of equals. I am the product and Chris the agent and manager and negotiator. She is indefatigable and also undaunted. If someone says no, she doesn't get discouraged or take it personally, but simply believes that she was talking to the wrong person. And trust me on this, she will find the right person, no matter how long it takes. When somebody approaches me about a business deal, I listen and say, "You have to talk to my manager about it," and silently wish him or her good luck, because they are going to need it if they think they are going to out-negotiate Chris. It makes me relieved that I am just the product. Chris and I and all the kids are truly one big happy family in the early 1990s. It is a profound moment of my life, the most profound moment. I am a father, a real father, not a pretend one or a preoccupied one or a selfish one, no matter how well-meaning. Chris has welcomed Bert and Casey and Brandon and Brody into our lives with loving and gracious arms. Their moms have custody, but they visit regularly. Chris adores my kids as much as I adore her kids, another aspect of our partnership. But the complexities of divorce make things difficult. Linda married David Foster, a very successful record producer, also in 1991. I felt that both Linda and I had successfully managed to get on with our lives. Our divorce settlement had been reached quickly without acrimony. Then, in the mid-1990s, Linda files for support payments with the Los Angeles Superior Court. It was her right and prerogative under California law. The case is ultimately settled with a minimal monthly payment, and I don't think much of anything was achieved except legal fees. We are initially subpoenaed late at night. Chris is upset, very upset, that her efforts to be a good stepmother are not appreciated. She is no longer inclined to make the effort. She also feels that both Linda and Christy really don't want the kids to be with us. Every time she invites them to do something, she feels there is some excuse as to why they can't come. When asked many years later, the Jenner kids have a different viewpoint. Chris just did not want them around anymore once we had our own children, fierce in her belief that I had only one family now, and that was her and the Kardashians. Linda and Christy say they never did anything to stop our kids from spending time with Chris and me. An entire book can be written on who did what to whom without any agreement or resolution. Everybody has a version, including me. None of which matters anyway. Bert and Casey and Brandon and Brody are my children, and it was incumbent upon me to see them and make them part of my life regardless of what others wanted or didn't want. The kids are a part of my life, and I had to do whatever it took to make them a part of my life. I needed to assert myself, but I could not. So I let go of them, which is a softer way of saying I abandoned them, because I did abandon them. I begin to see less and less of the Jenner children. As the years go by, I barely see them at all. My parental efforts are concentrated entirely on the raising of the Kardashian children, and then Kendall and Kylie. I miss birthdays with the Jenner kids. I miss graduations, either because I am not invited or am invited and just don't come. Bert idolizes the rugged and daring image of Bruce, and I piss on it. When Casey gets married in 2007, I am not invited. Nor should I have been, given my prolonged absence from her life, starting at the very beginning when I wasn't there for her birth. I cope the way I so often cope with things. I block the kids from my mind, almost as if they exist only as an abstraction, part of someone else's life. I also don't want to argue with Chris. I don't want to argue with Linda and Christy. I cannot deal with any kind of confrontation. I run from it. Confrontation leaves me terribly wounded and even more insecure and filled with self-doubt than I already am. I am scared of asserting myself and often try to deflect with a humorous quip. The Jenner kids have loving mothers and stepfathers. So maybe that's what I tell myself. They are doing fine and don't really need me. It is another way of coping with my guilt in not fighting as hard as I should have to see them when they were growing into their adolescence and young adulthood. I employ my now ingrained psychological mechanism when I am faced with something emotionally wrenching. I act as if I am powerless, that it wasn't my fault. There was nothing I could do. I make myself a helpless victim. I do the same with my sister, who has been such a mainstay in my life and whom I have adored since I was little. When Chris threw a party to celebrate the 20th anniversary of my Olympic win, Pam was not invited. Neither was my mother. My dad was. Pam was devastated. Out of deference to me, she had not told a single soul of my gender dysphoria for roughly a decade, although it only made it that much harder for her to process it. Chris had not wanted her there, a reaffirmation that the only family that should matter to me now was her family, and I went along with the decision. It created a terrible rupture between Pam and me. We rarely spoke for almost 20 years. I could blame my gender dysphoria for what happened. There is a tendency to blame everything that goes south in your life on gender dysphoria. Insecurity and self-doubt do envelop you. But none of that somehow justifies abandoning your own children, some of them for roughly a decade, or the sister you idolized growing up. Then it's just a sad excuse, and yet, it's the excuse I told myself. If God refuses to make peace with me, this will be the primary reason. It should be. In 1995, Kendall comes into our lives. It is an incredible moment, one that at a certain point we thought would never happen. I have been off hormone therapy for several years, but one of the possible side effects of therapy is that you shoot blanks, so to speak. Actually, you aren't shooting much of anything. Chris and I discussed it, and then together consulted with an endocrinologist, who, after examination, said that everything had returned to normal now that I had stopped the therapy. Kendall will go on to become a young woman of poise and beauty and kindness, the most down-to-earth of all the K-girls, and a little bit of a daredevil athlete like her father. She handles the fame she has already had in her life with steadiness, as at home at a riding stable as she is walking the catwalk for Chanel. Kylie follows 21 months later, as incredible as her sister, but with a distinctly different personality. Fiery and exotic beauty, headstrong and like her mother, with a sixth sense for business. After Chris gets pregnant with Kendall, I become increasingly concerned about the breasts. I worry that I won't even be able to go to a swimming pool because they are so obviously noticeable. These are not man boobs, folks. These are breasts. You don't go to a plastic surgeon to get man boobs removed. Imagine your own father having them while continuing to maintain that he is a man. Actually, don't. I talk to Chris about it. We go to a Beverly Hills plastic surgeon. He takes pictures of my chest, and my paranoia is such that I worry that somehow, some way, they are going to get out, even though they are taken from the shoulders down, so nobody would know who the hell it was anyway. But this is my thinking, always scared and terrified of discovery. I tell him they are the residue of steroid use, a condition known as gynecomastia, which of course is a lie. I have never taken any steroids in my life. But at this point, I am willing to sully my own reputation. The procedure is easy. He basically liposuctions them out, and from the vantage point of looking like a normal father, I do look much better. But from the vantage point of myself, I am sad for months afterward. I liked having them. Not only did they make me feel good about myself, I feel that my chest always should have been that way. On the other hand, trying to hide them has become a pain in the neck. On windy days, I am constantly pulling my shirt down so you can't see them. On one occasion, I am walking across the street with Chris, and the shirt is loose, and I keep grabbing at it. I know what you're doing. Yeah, I don't want anybody to see them. So as sad as I am to get rid of them, it is the only thing to do. I am stuck in Bruce mode forever, and that's that. Turn your focus elsewhere. I love being a father and stepfather to the Kardashians and Kendall and Kylie. I love raising kids. I love watching them grow up, taking them on trips, carpooling, anything and everything. It is my life in the 1990s and 2000s and 2010s, although I always know that no matter how much I try to block it out, there are four other wonderful children I have left behind. It is because of Chris that my social life expands, leading to a bizarre and ultimately horrifying relationship for both of us. She is extremely close with Nicole Brown Simpson, which also means that OJ comes into my life. I already know him a little bit, and a little bit goes a very long way because of his endless braggadocio. We have both come out of the same world of the male athlete with all its stereotypes and behavioral expectations, a type of identity that I come to call the male athlete gender. I struggled against it because of my issues and extreme discomfort in that world and its constant objectification of women, and the endless bragging about fucking to the point where you had to wonder what these guys were really hiding. OJ was at the completely opposite side of the spectrum as me, women as eye candy and sex toys, physically abusive when he did not get his way or felt he was being defied, the loud life of the party anywhere and any time, like so many other athletes. I did not care when my fame faded in the 1980s. I was consumed by something far more important. Fame was never important to me, except as a means to an end in having a career. OJ could not